Hey everyone. Even though we are currently in a pandemic, the recent killings of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, Nina Pop, and more have led people to take to the streets. Protests and marches from Minneapolis to Atlanta, Louisville to St. Louis, and beyond have sparked a renewed uprising for Black lives. And when looting and vandalism began to impact large chain stores and small Black businesses alike, many began asking, how can they support small Black businesses during this time? And people began following campaigns such as Buy Black, Bank Black, and hashtag Blackout Day 2020 to uplift Black businesses and communities that have been devalued and poverty-stricken for years.
A lot of people say that we live in a brutal neighborhood. I mean, I just learned if you treat people good and if you give what you have and you present everything well, that they, you know, your feedback will always be positive.
In this episode, we hear from two small Black business owners about what it's like to own a small business during this time and what hardships they faced obtaining loans as a Black business owner. And we ask an economic development specialist and a scholar of race and structural inequality, what's at stake if we continue to devalue Black businesses in the midst of an uprising for Black lives and beyond? I'm Lauren Brown, and from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. During the pandemic, small business owners have had to adapt to shelter-in-place orders, and the loss of business hit restaurants, barbershops, and stores especially hard. This has been especially challenging for small Black business owners, who are more likely to rely on their own resources to start and sustain their businesses than their non-Black counterparts. To help you understand what it's like to be a small Black business owner during this time, we spoke to Flavia Moore.
I'm Flavia Moore. I am the CEO of Crawling Crab.
Starting a business wasn't always a part of Flavia's plans. She was working at a telecommunications company full-time when she decided to sell food to raise extra money to take her daughter on a vacation.
I wanted to take my daughter on a Disney cruise. We went on a Disney trip annually to Magic Kingdom, so we wanted to go on a Disney cruise instead. She kept saying something about a Disney cruise, so we said we were going to sell platters to go on a Disney cruise. We put it on Facebook, and the feedback that we received was, like, it was astonishing.
The outpouring support from her community led her to take a leap of faith, leave her day job, and pursue her own business full time.
The money that I made in 2 days, it was like more than my check. It was double my check. So I quit, and I said I would never go back. And from that day, I just put everything that I had into Crawling Crab. I continued to beat my craft until Crawling Crab became what it is today.
But when St. Louis City and St. Louis County issued shelter-in-place orders on March 23rd, Flavia was faced with the decision to shut down or adapt to a new business model.
I'm the type of person, I prepare for the worst-case scenarios. I always think ahead of me. So I didn't really panic in the time during the pandemic. I did close. I took the safety precautions because I do have 4 children and they're small children. So I did close down March 31st because you cannot really practice social distancing in the kitchen. But I did go ahead and take the precautions and close down just to keep, just for the health of the environment, the safety of our employees and other customers. I didn't want anyone to come in contact with anything.
Her customers have remained loyal and eager for her to reopen when the time is right.
My support system is great as far as my customers, my crabbers. I refer to all my customers as crabbers. They have been 100% supportive. They are patiently waiting for me to open. A lot of them have been writing me, letting me know, I will not eat anywhere else. I'm waiting on you to open. When are you opening? Please open back up. But that's been the hardest thing for me, just not being able to give them food. Like, they love it. So even the people next door is like, hey, you bring a crowd over here. They knock on the door over here and ask, when are you going to open back up? So that's the hardest part for me, not being able to satisfy my customers with food.
The pandemic has forced many businesses, large and small, to close their doors permanently. But the same dedication and commitment to her business and customers that allowed her to leave her day job also motivated her to seek resources to help her business survive another day. With the help of Beyond Housing, a community development organization located in North St. Louis County, she applied for the Paycheck Protection Program loan offered by the Small Business Administration through the CARES Act.
I applied for the Paycheck Protection Program so that we can be able to have the employees taking care of the Paycheck Protection Program. That did take a while for everything to, you know, get processed, and I had to wait for the second round. I didn't make the first round, and it was a lot of different things with that. So I'm just now getting the Paycheck Protection Program money, and my employees will just now start getting paid off of that. So they'll be getting like back pay. I'll take care of them.
She experienced processing delays, not just from the initial rejection, but also during the application, which she had to redo 13 times.
I had to redo it and fax it and scan it back. And it was like, okay, well, the numbers isn't correct. And then it was just every little thing we had to do, redo the numbers. Like every time we sent in a new piece of paper, we had to go back and redo numbers. And then it was like the format wasn't working. So they wanted me to go back and get the original document, which I had to go through and contact, you know, my payroll team, had to contact them to figure out how to get the original IRS form. Then I had to go through myself and, you know, download the form. It's a fillable form, go in and fill it in. Then we had to keep going back to do it. We had to keep going back to do our numbers over after we got those forms.
The SBA states that the loan is designed to help small businesses keep employees on payroll through the COVID-19 crisis. But calculating maximum loan amounts can be overwhelming, especially for first-time small business owners. Depending on the type of business you run, you might need numbers on past net profits, gross wages, and tips, contributions for health insurance and retirement plans, monthly payroll amounts for the last year, and more. Making matters worse, small business owners like Flavia have to compete with businesses that have up to 500 employees or more, depending on industry standards and the number of employees per location. And like many Black small business owners who have invested their own resources into their business, Flavia is hesitant to take on more debt, which is why she's not applying for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, also offered by the SBA.
Everything else has pretty much been like overcapacitated, and it's like the websites were shut down when I was trying. So the only thing that I've done was the PPP.
There's even more paperwork for the PPP loan forgiveness application, which documents that funds are being used toward payroll costs, interest on mortgages, rent, and utilities, with over half of the funds being used on payroll. And even though making payroll is crucial for small business owners, for those with fewer employees, being able to pay mortgage, rent, and utilities is often what determines whether or not a business can survive the pandemic. Flavia's business has been so successful that she's been able to transition from pop-ups in a shared space to leasing her own space from Beyond Housing.
We had to open up a restaurant and close down a whole restaurant every day because we were sharing it. So now I can say that weight is off my shoulder, and I'm just glad to have the space. They have done everything to try to make sure that I'm okay. They are even figuring out ways to do tenant funding and make sure that I still be able to live day to day, even, you know, if I'm not financially failing. They're not looking at my bank account. They're just saying, hey, I know it's a pandemic going on and our tenants need help.
It's been challenging for Flavia to figure out how to survive the current crisis while also bringing her business back safely.
The loan process is kind of frustrating. So I just rather not, me personally, I just rather not do it after the PPP. What I'm going to do is just I'm going to open back up and I'll make the money because when I started my business, I didn't really have any loans and I really don't want to accumulate loans. The grants are fine. I think every small business should be able to get like a grant. I think they should be able to get a grant because you lose so much. Like I've lost so much money just taking safety precautions. I've lost out on so much money. So I would definitely give them grant. Another thing is I would supply them all with like the face masks and everything because I'll spend a lot of money on just applying face masks.
And even though Flavia has gone through many changes, she is still motivated to reach her ultimate goal.
My overall outcome of this is I want to be able to franchise. So once I'm able to get all the information and everything that I need together for all of my restaurant managers and everything, I'll be able to franchise and I'll go to another state and start another location. So that's what's getting me through. I'm just motivated to finish.
As Flavia works toward her dream of franchising her business, other small Black business owners are navigating the pandemic with multiple businesses.
The name is Marlon Austin, and the name of one of our companies is Three Vegan Brothers.
Entrepreneurship runs in Marlon's family.
My grandfather was a business owner in St. Louis, and he owned a cab company, and he owned a Standard Oil gas station. So he had the entrepreneurial spirit. So, you know, it came over to me and my twin brother. And from the moment I can remember, I mean, even when I was a little kid, I was always thinking about, you know, creating things and making it into a business.
Now Marlon and his brother co-own two family businesses, Three Vegan Brothers, a vegan food company, and Bespoke Couture, a bespoke custom clothing company. Three Vegan Brothers started when Marlon's mother started her vegan journey in 2011. She loved the health benefits of the vegan lifestyle, but she couldn't give up cheese. So she started researching how to make vegan cheese and began making her own recipes with different nuts and even created nut-free versions with seeds as well.
We started the business in 2012. At that point, we were just selling it locally. My mother would make it and we would sell it to our friends and colleagues and stuff like that. And people were like, yeah, you need to sell this, you know.
Marlon's business sense led him to adopt a business model that would not only grow his business, but ultimately prepare him for the pandemic.
I knew the future was going to be to go. And now here we are. I didn't know this pandemic was going to happen. But, you know, I knew that the future of grocery was going to be, you know, to-go items. So my idea was if we can package this cheese right, it can be sold, you know, at schools, at movie theaters, at grocery stores, at convenience stores, you know, everywhere. That was my idea.
But with all of his creativity and business savvy, it was still hard for Marlon to get his cheese on the shelves of major retailers and grocery stores.
Being, I guess, a Black entrepreneur, a so-called Black entrepreneur, if you want to say that, you know, Whole Foods, many people have reached out, you know, and had us send samples to them. And we've got the production capacity. But it's always something like, you know, Whole Foods was like, well, we think the price is too high. I'm like, really, I've been a client of yours since 2001 and I buy $10 candy bars from you. So I don't think it's too expensive, you know. And, you know, so it's always an excuse. They love the product. They like the way it's packaged. And, you know, it's always been a mindset that we've got to be overachievers. Everything's got to be on the highest level so that when they come and inspect everything, then, you know, they can see it. But in my opinion, it was always something. I mean, our cheese should be sold everywhere. You know what I'm saying? And it isn't.
And even in his hometown of St. Louis, getting the support and space he needs to expand his business has been a challenge. He's experienced delays in getting a commercial kitchen to the point that he is now operating the cheese-making business out of Chicago and shipping product to St. Louis.
I find that we always do very well either outside of this country or outside of this state, you know, unfortunately. It is what it is. We've got lots of people that want to carry the cheese. And, you know, this event occurred, so that's affected everybody's business. So we'll see how we move forward with that. But, you know, it always seems to be a level of resistance here.
Those obstacles are one reason why it's been important for Marlon to own multiple businesses. The other reason is his passion for fashion. He and his twin brother have been running their bespoke clothing business, Bespoke Couture, for almost 30 years internationally.
As far as business goes, I've always been, you know, I'm always looking for the next thing, you know. not the next gimmick, but coming up with the next thing and how it can benefit people.
But in the fashion industry, Marlon and his twin brother experienced the same obstacles as they did in the food business, which is the common experience of Black people needing to work twice as hard to receive only half as much as their white counterparts, especially in the U.S.
When we went over to Italy, I made a decision. I told my brother, I'm like, either I'm going to stay in this business. I said, we're going to stay if we go overseas. Because I had done prior business overseas before, and it was very open and very receptive. And my brother was like, let's do it. And we went over there, and we basically were featured in every men's magazine that's known to men in the fashion industry. But then yet in the United States, we haven't been featured in GQ or Esquire, but we've been featured in GQ Russia, GQ Italia, GQ Brazil, you know, GQ Japan, you know, all these things. So it's just, you know, it is the way it is in the United States. There's always blockades and everything put in your way. And we all always made a very good product and we did very well. But, you know, we were faced with issues with people, to be quite frankly, trying to block us from succeeding.
As COVID-19 impacts businesses across the country, Marlon has adapted by focusing on online sales to make up for the loss of local business.
This pandemic has definitely hurt us. But on the flip side of that, we had a nice amount of revenue coming in from internet sales. So we are able to ship, you know, nationwide. The accounts locally that we had, they have decreased, of course, because they went from you being able to walk into their establishment, whether it was dining or a grocery store or whatever, to curbside and pick up and all that. So that has hurt the local business tremendously.
To obtain more financial support for his business, Marlon also applied for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, EIDL Advance, offered through the Small Business Administration. The EIDL Advance makes up to $10,000 available to businesses experiencing a temporary loss of revenue.
When they talked about the EIDL, I was the first to do it when that site came open. And we've got three businesses. So I had my brother apply, I applied, and then we had our younger brother apply for one too. So initially they said the first, I think, 25 million businesses would get $10,000 grant. And wouldn't have to pay it back, which, you know, that would have helped every small business.
You don't have to be approved for a loan in order to receive the EIDL advance. And the advance doesn't need to be repaid, but it does count against total loan eligibility. For example, if Marlon also applied for a Paycheck Protection Program loan, the EIDL amount that he was approved for would be deducted from the PPP loan amount. But Marlon didn't end up applying for the Paycheck Protection Program loan because it was over capacity.
Now, on the PPP, I looked at that and I didn't see a benefit really from that. But yet I was going to apply. And when I went to my bank, they were like, hey, we've already done the amount of people we want to do. Then I had my brother go to, we got another relationship with a bank and they said the same thing. So that was just like out. So it was some stressful nights, you know. But I'm like, hey, I guess the universe gave me my answer, you know, because if I was meant to get the PPP loan, I would have got it.
Like Flavia, Marlon thinks grants are more helpful than loans for small business owners because loans can cause additional debt that's difficult to repay during a pandemic.
So we're forced to shut down. And the government says, I got an idea. We're going to give you a loan. In my opinion, they should have been giving everybody grant money. It should have never been a loan, you know, because when you come in with loans, it's based on criteria, who people have a relationship with, blah, 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 you know, and it trickled down from the largest businesses down to nothing.
Black business owners face many hardships when trying to obtain a loan for their business due to implicit biases and structural racism in finance and banking industries. And when Black business owners are eligible for a loan, the loan terms don't always help a business stay financially secure, especially in a recession.
I might add that the SBA did offer our cheese business a 30-year loan for $1,6500, which was insulting, you know, because, you know, you know what your sales are annually, you know. So we don't even know how they came up with that number, you know, unless they don't have any more money to loan out, you know. But who would take out a, you know, the SBA is in the payday loan business now. I just don't, you know, that was insulting. So, you know, it was laughable. I had to put that on social media. I was so outdone. But the thing that was going through my head was I was just kind of upset and angry that, you know, your solution is loans, you know. And who feels comfortable taking out a loan when we don't even know what the future is going to be, you know? And being a Black-owned business, you know, I've experienced my share of how things go, you know, when a Black person goes to try to get a loan for his business. And, you know, I'm not saying how it went, you know, I'm not saying if that played a factor, but all I can tell you is that when I decided to apply, they told me all the money had been allocated, all the applications on the people that they wanted to give it to had been done. So there it is. And we're not going to be in debt for 30 years for $1,000 to $6,500. No way. You know, that's a hang me loan. What can you do with that? You know, that's not for serious business people.
So what options are available for serious business people? The answer, especially for small Black business owners, isn't that straightforward. The availability of and eligibility for SBA loans has shifted over time, and structural racism has prevented Black business owners from accessing traditional financing options. So up next, we'll hear from an economic development specialist about what it's like to help Black business owners navigate COVID-19 relief. And a scholar of race and structural inequality will outline what needs to be changed for Black small business owners to truly prosper.
Hey everyone, it's Jalian. The pandemic continues to wreak havoc on economies around the world. And in the US, Black-owned businesses are among those getting hit the hardest, as racial inequities in accessing credit and capital are exacerbated by the coronavirus-induced recession. That makes the ever-shifting landscape of COVID-19 relief even more complicated for people like Erica Hallman, an economic development specialist at Beyond Housing, who introduced us to the Black small business owners we met at the top of the show. We interviewed her at the end of June, after she shifted her focus from helping Black small business owners lease physical spaces to assisting them with applying for COVID-19 relief.
Pretty much up until last week, almost all of our conversations have been around finding resources. Almost all of our conversations have been around specifically, how do we get capital into your business? How do we get dollars into your business to help you weather this storm?
Even though most of the federal relief from the CARES Act has come in the form of Small Business Administration loans, Erica has been keeping her eye out for grants, which many Black small business owners prefer.
We don't know if the new normal is going to look anything at all like the old one. So it's with those uncertainties and also with the historic issues there have been with lending to Black-owned businesses and to folks in Black communities, there's a lot of concern from our business owners of taking on debt. So we've really tried to focus on helping find them grants and other supports that feel less risky and that can help them be more secure in this time.
Redlining practices have historically barred Black people from obtaining home loans, resulting in reduced access to home equity, an important source of capital for small business owners. And predatory lenders in predominantly Black neighborhoods have made many Black business owners understandably wary of loans, even if they have the credit history to qualify.
Each one of the business owners had different stories on, you know, why and backgrounds on why this was a concern. Somebody had recently been through a divorce that caused them to have to claim bankruptcy. One of our business owners had always run everything through their business credit because she's been in business for over 10 years, but her personal credit was non-existent as a result.
That's why many Black small business owners have relied on their own limited resources to launch and grow their businesses, even during the pandemic.
One of our business owners even ended up, while she's owning and running and maintaining two businesses, coming up with flexible strategies, even got a part-time job just to be able to make sure that she would be able to make payroll for her employees with the limited hours that she was able to run.
But working a part-time job while running multiple businesses is unsustainable for most, and the pandemic has forced many small business owners to seek additional support with no guarantees of receiving it. Erica explains that it's been frustrating for small business owners to be faced with frequent changes to the availability of and eligibility requirements for federal aid, such as the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, EIDL, offered through the Small Business Administration.
$10,000 within 3 days of applying guaranteed is what was originally written. It got adjusted by the SBA, but that constant disappointment of, you know, saying $10,000 guaranteed within 3 days turns into weeks of not knowing, turns into you hear in the news that the SBA has changed the guidance and it's $1,000 per employee, turns into here we are almost at the end of June. And some of these folks applied on the very first day these programs were available. And several of our business owners still haven't even heard back.
Several of those business owners have also faced silence on whether or not their applications for Paycheck Protection Program loans have been accepted or denied.
When PPP was completely ran out in 13 days and none of our business owners had received so much as a confirmation of an application number, the Chamber of Commerce opened up a fund during the weeks right after the PPP fund had been completely tapped, and their website was overloaded and that fund was tapped within less than 24 hours, which speaks both to the really great need. But for me, there's a really great need, but it felt personal that all of these Black-owned businesses were the ones that were being left out. It felt personal that it was these small businesses with 25 employees or left were being left out, while corporations and with, you know, or even institutions like Harvard with very sizable endowments, and, you know, businesses that were sort of getting around the 500 employee or less mark by 500 employees or less at one location. It just seemed wrong that they were competing against businesses that had 25 employees or less, you know, 5 employees or less.
An oversight report released in May from the Small Business Administration Office of the Inspector General found that even though underserved and rural markets were supposed to be prioritized under the CARES Act, this didn't happen when the Paycheck Protection Program was first implemented. This means that in the first rounds of the program, many Black-owned businesses may not have received the loans they needed to keep staff on payroll, when over $300 billion in loans were being approved. And the SBA didn't initially collect standard optional demographic data on borrower applications or loan forgiveness forms. So there's not an easy way to hold the SBA accountable for equitable disbursement of loans in those first rounds. Loan level data released by the SBA on Monday, July 6th, continues to raise questions about whether the current administration and the SBA has been responsive enough to the needs of small business owners, and particularly to Black small business owners. Currently, data on race, ethnicity, and gender of borrowers is being collected, but many applicants are leaving those items unanswered. And the data on loan size and jobs retained tell a story about a program that has loaned millions of dollars to large businesses, law firms, and religious organizations, some with ties to members of Congress and the current administration. Meanwhile, Black business owners who own and operate multiple small businesses are especially vulnerable because of the same entrepreneurial spirit and self-reliance that ensured their success before the pandemic.
It seems like we were punishing people for doing the thing that exactly what they were supposed to do. We were, you know, every single one of these businesses are Black owned. They all have started these businesses with zero capital from anyone else other than themselves. They never received money from a bank. They never received a loan. And they've done the things that you're, you know, quote unquote, supposed to do. I do have to say one of the beautiful things about working with entrepreneurs is they've faced so many challenges to get here, especially for Black-owned businesses, that this, for most of the business owners we work with, the idea that they may not survive has never crossed their lips and hardly ever their minds. They know that it's a reality that they are being put in such danger economically that, you know, the I'm not sure how we'll do it thought has crossed their minds, but because they've crossed so many bridges and so many times that have been so tough, and they've always found a creative solution and a way to get through it, that is the beauty of working with entrepreneurs, is there's always a new idea, and they know that they'll find a new idea that's going to get them through. It's that sense of justice that also helps drive me in terms of knowing that we have to get something for our businesses, knowing we have to get dollars in their hands, knowing we have to help them survive and that they deserve it. They have done everything in their power. They continue to do everything in their power every single day, and they have done it for years, for decades, you know, in a country that has been built against them for 400 years. And, you know, so whatever it takes to help them survive, that I think we just have to do it. We have to figure it out.
Meet Dr. Andre Perry, a scholar of race and structural inequality who shares that sense of justice and is doing the research to figure out what needs to be done to ensure that Black businesses and communities can prosper.
We've grown accustomed to inequality, sadly, and it will continue if we don't do something about it. But I believe that enough is enough, that people are tired. You hear this all the time. They're tired. And people know their value, that people understand that I'm worth it, that I'm willing to go through whatever it takes to get the value that's been extracted by racism, get it back to my community. They're willing to do whatever it takes. So I'm encouraged, as our millions of people in the streets today around the world. Folks are tired, and they're willing to stand up and do something about it.
There is risk involved with taking to the streets and rising up for Black lives in the midst of a pandemic. But Dr. Perry suggests that flattening the curve of racial bias by addressing policies and structures that continue to marginalize African Americans is just as important as flattening the curve for COVID-19.
We keep talking about flattening the curve of the virus and in ways that we look at the harm of the virus, but the virus is, you know, doesn't discriminate. Our past policies have. If we really want to flatten the curve, it really means addressing the structural inequalities that make Black people more vulnerable. And that means correcting for the policy violence that is inflicted upon Black communities every single day.
He draws a connection between the policy violence that devalues Black business owners like Flavia and Marlon and the state violence that has caused people to take to the streets.
The same attitudes that Derek Chauvin, the former officer who killed George Floyd in the middle of the street in broad daylight, the same attitudes he had are the same attitudes that bankers have, that lenders have, appraisers, that employers have, that heads of corporations have.
Even though overt redlining is illegal under the Fair Housing Act, structural racism persists in the finance and banking industries, leading to the devaluation of homes in Black communities.
I looked at home prices in Black communities and compared them to home prices in white communities, and I controlled for education, crime, walkability, all those fancy Zillow metrics. And what I found was that homes in Black communities are devalued by 23%, about $48,000 per home, which means that cumulatively, there's about $156 billion in lost equity in Black communities. And we know that $156 billion is used to send kids to college, to start businesses. It's used by municipalities to fund education, policing, and infrastructure. And so that loss really is a loss in helping people deal with the inevitable economic shocks that will come.
This lost equity makes it harder for Black entrepreneurs to start and sustain businesses and results in a lack of cushion to help their businesses survive the pandemic. Dr. Perry explains that these obstacles existed before the pandemic, with Black people receiving business loans at about half the rate of their white peers and at worse interest rates from mainstream banks.
It was only like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, where banks were telling Black folks, no, you don't belong here. This straight up, you do not belong here.
Black business owners have better luck with Black-owned banks and community development financial institutions, CDFIs, which are private sector financial institutions that focus on serving, training, and investing in individuals and communities who are underserved by the traditional banking system.
So when the Treasury, in their wisdom, and I say that in quotes, to use mainstream banks to let out the PPP loans, I threw my hands up in disgust when I heard that, because I knew that meant that, one, banks are going to work with existing customers first, because that's what they are going to do. But many Black people are unbanked in that regard. And so when it rolled out, no one should have been surprised that 95% of Black businesses did not get the payroll protection plan loans from the as part of the CARES Act. 95%. Now, you don't need whites only signs to discriminate. And that's when people say structural racism. This is what they're talking about. People don't have to yell out the N-word or hold up Confederate flags for a racist outcome to occur. These things are baked into policy and practices.
On Monday, June 1st, the SBA and the Treasury approved $10 billion in round two funding of the Paycheck Protection Program to be lent exclusively by CDFIs. But this is only a fraction of the over $500 billion in loans that have already been approved through the PPP under the CARES Act. And the amount allocated to the Minority Business Development Agency, an agency of the U.S. Department of Commerce, for educating, training, and advising small and minority businesses to recover from the COVID-19 crisis, was even less.
When the CARES Act announced that only $10 million was going to the Minority Business Development Agency, and that's the agency that works closely with Black-owned banks and CDFIs, when they announced that only $10 million out of a $2 trillion bill, you don't have to be a math major to know that's 0.00001%. I knew right then and there they weren't trying to solve this problem. That if we really want to solve the problem, we would empower the financial institutions that are most proximate to Black people, Black and brown people. And they did not. And so one of the, what's clear is the solution is that we need to empower CDFIs, Black-owned banks, and other institutions that have great relationships and proximity to Black and brown folk. However, because of divestment, many of these institutions simply right now do not have the capacity. But it's clear that if we're going to pour all this money into big banks, they should lend their technology to Black-owned banks and CDFIs in ways that enables them to have the kind of volume that's required during times like this.
Dr. Perry points out that banking is a relationship-driven business, and correcting that divestment will require timely and intentional investment in Black and brown institutions, businesses, and communities.
We need to prioritize Black people, Black businesses, brown people, brown businesses, because historically they've been disadvantaged and devalued and dismissed over time. And so the first come, first serve nature of the PPP program, for instance, should have been directed towards Black institutions, Black businesses first. Because if you can cover Black businesses first, you know the folks who, quote unquote, have 90-day cash on hand will survive.
Honoring and demanding the full value of Black lives is what Dr. Perry continues to do with his scholarship as people amplify that call in the streets.
The folks in the street are providing me the leverage to speak out more, to be clear, to be more forceful. Because if they can risk their lives by going out there and marching, I can surely put up the facts. You know, and so I say, keep doing what we're doing. Keep putting pressure on these criminal justice issues. It's working for everyone else. What we're learning is you can't divorce social justice from economic justice. And one will influence the other. It will help if we have the same kind of movement in the economic space. We're going to get what we have been receiving if we don't change. Black people suffering more, the economy will be throttled by a lack of participation of Black residents. Black people will continue to suffer, and we will still have this immoral weight around our neck because we have not dealt with the crimes of the past upon Black communities. And so these injustices that we've grown accustomed to must go away. I mean, we are so numb to the prejudice, the wealth stripping. I grew up in Black cities. I have a Black son, Black wife. My writing surely will be devalued. My thoughts will be devalued. My life will be devalued. And so this is very personal to me. This is not just about me doing some kind of academic exercise. This is about saving my life, my son's life, my community's life. This is about the way I protest. This is about how I participate in change. And so this is not a game for me. This is not an academic exercise. For me, it's about, you know, being authentic, saving lives, doing the good work. But I have a self-interest in it because I'm Black and the outcomes are weighted against me.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. To learn more about Dr. Andre Perry's research, check out his recent book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. This show is overseen by Robert Peterson, Director of Radio Programming and Operations at St. Louis Public Radio, from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX. This is We Live Here. Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.